Hello, Charles Lloyd. Michael Fremmer calling.
Michael.
How are you?
Thank you for checking in. I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I mean, these days you have to ask everybody.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I wasn't going to give you that long answer, you know.
Yeah, good. Okay, so.
You asked the guy how he's doing, you know, centuries ago, and he tell you all kinds of stuff, and you said, never ask him again. Yeah, sorry.
Well, good. So, but how has this affected your touring schedule and everything that you have lined
well,
up?
Well, you know, it's life out here, and it gets stranger all the time. Well, the tours are being canceled, so I don't know how to address that. I just Dorothy runs that program, and when it's time to go, she lets me know. And in the meantime, I'm in my laboratory trying to stir up these elixirs, you know. So.
It's good to have that taken care of, isn't it? Not to have to do that part of the job.
Oh man, I could. Function, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, it seems to me that since I've been following your recorded career, that you've been trying to wipe out the ugliness with beauty and make this a blissful place where a man can live in harmony since at least 1969. So I have to characterize your 50-plus year effort on the world stage as a complete failure, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to go into the wings with beginner's mind and love of the music and the experience has been mixed, you know. But
well, I was going to finish with my statement by saying, on a personal level, you appear to have been 100% successful. So.
Oh no! You well, you know, I'm still the banana peel's out here for all of us. There's no.
But that's good, right? Isn't, you need that, otherwise
you're
complacent. Yeah, of
course. I mean, it is as it is. You know, the old Buddhist thing. You know, you can't. You don't make a better world. You know, it's. I mean, I wanted to do that, but I was naive. You know, and I'm still naive, and I'm not signing up for lobotomy or proctology. You know, so I'm not the guy to have these kind of conversations.
Yeah, naivete is good. It's good. It's a good thing to maintain, I think.
Well, you know, you have to find some way to function through here. And this place is a gymnasium. It's a school, you know, and you pass through here.
Yeah, well, those have all been closed.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, so like that. So you have to work with what you got.
Yeah. So you have a master's degree from the University of Southern California.
I never went back to get the paper, so let's straighten that one out in case some pedantic ones are out there. I stayed on to do graduate work. What happened was my buddies all left town, Ornette and Cherry and Higgins and everybody left. And I was there, and another coconut would hit me on the head, and another day would go by, and I'd get depressed, you know. So when I graduated from SC, you see, I come from the South, so that whole thing is about, you know, your mother say you have to have the paper, you know, a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And you have to, then you have to get a teaching credential just in case something to fall back on, they call it in those days. Well, you don't have anything.
I still tell that to young people today. I tell them the same thing.
Well, no, I tell them to do music because you love it, and don't get that other thing in your... And get those other bells in your eyes.
At all? No fallback? You want people to...
Oh, no, I tell them to do music because you love it. You have to go and be a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief like Duke and those guys told me. My mother took me backstage, you know, because Duke, they were staying at our house, you know, and she said, he wants to be a musician so bad, and Johnny Hodges and Duke and all, they chimed in and said, let that boy be a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. This stuff is too hard.
It always was and it always is, but if you don't follow what you really believe in, then
yeah, I know.
What do you
So
those people all pass through your house?
I'm sorry?
Those people all pass through your house? Do
you know, when I was a little kid, yeah, my mom had a nice large house, and the lady who ran the theater up there, the W.C. Handy Theater, where Duke would come through town, and Hamp's band, and Basie, and Louis Armstrong, all these people come through town, and so... You know, there weren't adequate hotels, you know, so she would call.
Well, that's one way to put it, that there weren't adequate. I mean, there were other things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go negative. I know,
you're amazing.
The world's rough enough. Yeah. But I tell you one thing, in college, I was always trying to get up inside of the music. Oh, pardon me for digressing, but
that's
something
okay.
just jumped in there. You remember the Heath kits and those things like that?
The what?
Heath kit. There was some the audio files.
Oh, Heath kit. Of course, I built. Yeah, kit. I built some of those. Yeah.
Yeah, so you built those guys, all the guys in the dorm. They were building these Heath kits, yeah. You know. But I had eyes for, you know, JBL, you know, Paragons and Hartsfields, and I mean, I was always a dreamer, you know. And,
yeah, you needed a lot of money for those things.
And I didn't have any money, but you know, that didn't stop me. I later on in New York, I got, well, I was so thrilled when I got my Marantz 7C preamp.
Wow.
You know, and then I had a couple of Mac 60s, and I was, you know, still trying to find. What I was trying to do was get up inside of the music, and I'm still trying to do that. But the beauty is that what happens on the bandstand, it doesn't. You know, you guys can audiophile it to death, but man, there's nothing like live.
Well, of course not.
But I was naive enough to think that I'm going to be able to get up inside of this music. I'll tell you one thing though: when I was going to SC, some guy built some amplifiers. I don't know what it was, but you know, some music fan. Anyway, he brought these things over to my house. I never heard the music ever before, since, ever sound so great. And you know what the thing did? It burned up in my house.
It burned up?
Yeah.
Oh.
Went up in smoke. You know, the tubes and stuff, they just couldn't handle it. It was too good. It was too good.
Well, now they have much more stable circuits, so like when the guys come over to bring stuff for me to review, they don't turn it on and run away. I'm turning it on, and then they run away.
Too many stories. I'll stop. Please, Michael, how may I serve this?
No, place? stories are always good.
No, but I was just flashing at that time. I was up at Woodstock, and Dylan was playing for me. What's that record he made with just the three of them?
I heard you were when they made the band stuff at Big Pink. You were up there.
I was around. Yeah, well, we were all, you know, neighbors and friends. I knew those guys from Levon days.
Yeah,
I mean, from the Ronnie Harkins days. But anyway, because I was playing with Cannonball over in Atlantic City, and some music fan that liked those guys and liked me too hooked us up, and so Robbie and Levi, we became close. But what was I trying to tell you about that stuff?
Well, we were talking about music being live, not the same.
No, we've gone past that. No, just something more recent. Help me. You know, the thing about playing in the now is that you have musicians, and they say, "Oh," and you say, "Oh, thank you. It's over here. Good." You know, and then you just keep ascending. I'm sorry, brother man. I'm trying to. I guess I'm not meant for these times, or something.
Well, that was a Brian Wilson song, you know.
But some of this stuff is too crazy. Like Dylan lived around the corner, you know, and we were talking about Woodstock.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay,
that's where you were. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, when you have to do that when you're at the bandstand, you know, I'm anyway. So, a couple of things. Robbie took me over to Dylan's house, and Dylan played me John Wesley Harding on a little Columbia record player, because, you know, when you go from town to town, they'd bring out these little record players, and the distributors would let you use it while you were in town.
Right.
And, you know, a loner. And so I said, "Hey, well, where's your sister?" Because by this time, you know, I had my Marantz, and I had this. I don't know. Now, I'd left JBL by that time. I was over in there trying to get some KLH-9s or something crazy. Esoteric. I'd moved over into that arena because I tried those. What was those speakers? KLH and some the little ones. And then was it AR-3? Was that the
AR-3? Yeah, yeah.
That was a good little thing,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Little, yeah, good.
Oh, yeah, little speaker. For the day. Yeah, well, you know.
I owned those. I had those.
Yeah. Anyway, so,
by the way, you don't have to talk hi-fi to me. I'm perfectly capable of just.
No. It just dawned on me. But okay. what I'm getting at two points. First point, well, I won't do that. The first point was not just you audiophile guys. Man, I don't want to go there because
it's
too painful. No. I have this CD player from Audio Research that I just loved. Man, I think it was a CD2 or something. And then I just loved this. And then the damn thing stopped playing know what I mean? And then they talk, well, Phillips makes the transport. They don't have that anymore.
That's right.
But I'm not. I'm too damaged to hear stuff like that because I love that player. Anyway, so I asked Dylan why was he playing that stuff on, and he said that he had this great big old rambling thing up there on the hill, and so he said in Woodstock. So he said that he got tired of all those wires. So that's why he was listening on this little thing. Anyway, that was one part of it, and he thought maybe I should overdub and play on it. And I said, no, leave it alone. It's simple. But Weas was really deep, man.
Wow, you overdubbing on John Wesley Harding?
Well, yeah, he wanted me to. Well, no, that's what he wanted me to check it out and see if I'd have eyes to overdub on it. And I told him, no, thank you. I told him, leave it. It's fine like it is. Leave it alone.
That's probably a good idea.
So we're over at Grossman's house, and we're standing around the pool, and that's when he had those guys from India. Remember those guys out there in the garage? What was their names? From Bengal. Some street musicians Grossman had brought back. So he'd take out in the garage a bushel of apples, and he'd come back a little late, and all the apples be gone, because those guys were street guys. They didn't know when they'd eat again. You know, they didn't know if this guy was real or what this was, but we better deal with this. You know, anyway, but so Dylan says to me, Robbie says you're going to go. That's when I was getting ready to make my sabbatical, my getaway. So Dylan.
Getaway from everything, or just from music for a while, or what do you mean by a sabbatical?
No, from New York and the music business, and they smoke your eyelids and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and
I
couldn't get a straight count or nothing. And I'd gone to college, and I at least could figure out some stuff, but they didn't want me to ask those kind of questions. You could have women and drugs.
Right, but doesn't work.
When you start asking about the bread, that's a wrong question.
Oh, I got it. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so
that's
so,
the music business.
So Dylan said, you going back out there, man? He said, don't you? That place is going to fall into the. See, I'd gone to college out here, you know. So he said that place is going to fall into the ocean. I said, well, man, so be it. Well, we standing around Grossman's pool that had cracks all over. There was no water in it, you know. And he's telling me about what the West Coast is going to do. One day. I'm sitting in my living room looking out at the beach in Malibu Colony. So I got this little spot. So I look out on the beach, and there's the band out there taking an album cover photo. So I go out almost in front of my house. I go out and say, what's up? It's how Bob brought us out here. So now they're out here. You understand?
Yeah.
So if I was waiting on somebody to, you know, and he was. What was the word? Prescient or something when he found all that stuff would come through, you know.
Yeah, especially not like wires in a stereo, because now it's all wireless. So yeah.
Right. No, but I mean, the fact that he could come up with all those images and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
In the 60s, that was deep, you know. Anyway, pardon me, I'm at home and kind of zany and probably got cabin fever or something.
No, I'm enjoying this because you're going back coast to coast, which I like.
I move around, man. Then there was a guy making a documentary film on me who was a fan of them, and he brought Pet Sounds and Wild Honey over, and I, you know, it hit me because I like a lot of music, you know, so I was listening to the Ali Brothers and all kinds of stuff from Pakistan in those days. And
yeah.
when they brought that Pet Sounds and stuff, it was very moving.
Yeah, that record is moving, sure.
That guy had something, you know, he you know, and it's true, he did. I saw that thing. He had a sandbox up in his living room.
Yeah.
And stuff,
I ended up fixing his turntable when it was broken. When he was
over there in Bel Air?
When he was in his worst state, when he was living in the Santa Monica Hills.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, man, he was...
But to what time period are you talking?
This is early 80s. Early 80s.
No, I'm in the 70s.
Yeah.
Anyway, but he, you know that racist guy Edgar Rice Burroughs. He had bought his house over there in Bel Air.
Right.
And he had a studio in the basement, and so I, you know, Mike, they would take me over there. That's when I started recording on some of those records. I don't remember what they were in the moment. But anyway,
I think you were on Surf's Up.
Okay. Yeah. So and some other ones too. But anyway, so Brian would be upstairs, and he hear me down there stirring up that stuff, and then he come down and he get those guys. Whoever, neighbors, and they come over and they start singing, you know. And
I wanted to ask you about the time that you spent with Chico Hamilton. Is that something you want to talk about?
No, but I will. I mean, I don't have, you know, I don't have borders and stuff.
I mean,
what about it?
I think about the record, Man from Two Worlds. That's an amazing record that you.
It is.
It's you. It's all you. That record.
Yeah, that one, Man from Two Worlds. That was another one. What was it called?
There was
two out in that series.
There was Passing Through.
Passing Through, yeah. Passing Through, Man from Two Worlds. And did you ever come across another one called, Unreprieve. Reprise. That was a great record.
Don't know that one.
Oh man, you got to find that one. That was the end. That was the last one.
But you also did stuff with Chico in '65 after you had already signed to Columbia. How did that work?
Because we were just, you know, Gabor and I were friends, and Gabor was playing on. He had played on the record with Tony and Ron, of course. And we were in New York. We'd be hanging out.
Man from Two Worlds was world music ahead of world music?
Man from Two Worlds. That was special. That was special.
So yeah, that's a really, I mean, you were doing the Indian thing before the Beatles did the Indian thing. And
Thank you. Tell somebody that, man.
I will. I'm telling
you. I don't know why I got left here, and now the banksters are going to start coming, and the wolf will be at the door. I said, Dorothy, make sure we get away before the wolf's at the door. And sure enough, we didn't. And here, the wolf is out there. You know, that's rough.
There's probably a coyote or two out there.
But Caesar takes no... coyotes are friends around here. But my cats, we put them in at night.
No kidding.
Where do you live?
I live in New Jersey.
Oh, man. Always? No,
I lived in L.A. for 8 years. I was working in films in Hollywood.
Were you in...
I live in Venice.
My town poet buddy, were you all...
Joe, yeah. I've known Joe since probably late 70s.
He's the real deal.
He's
great,
man. I love Joe.
I don't find nobody like him.
No, he is unique. He is definitely unique.
And because, you know, I'm always a reluctant bride, and I don't, but... Yeah, anyway, Man from Two Worlds, thank you for picking up on that, man. Yeah. That was some bad shit, wasn't it?
Oh,
that,
man.
That bass player, Albert Stinson, on there, man, he's strong as... Oh.
What happened to him?
Oh, man, tragic magic, kind of. He was on the road with Larry Coryell, and they were up in Boston, and, you know, Yodi.
Yeah. That's the vibe I got. All of a sudden, he's there, and he's making that music.
Let me tell you something, man. There was a letter for a while, Bill Evans' letter or something, that was going around. I don't know, somebody underground kind of thing about Bill. Anyway, so a long time ago. And so this guy, Chuck Israels, was saying, well, Bill was looking for a bass player, and I knew the guy was Albert Stinson, but I tried to get blocked that best I could. Anyway, he got in and got the gig. But he said, man, do you know Stinson played with Miles one night with Tony and Wayne and Herbie and all that? And Miles, because Ron couldn't come out to the coast or something. And by that time, Stinson had come back home. And, man, there's a record. There's some music information floating around. Man, Stinson was just off the chart. No rehearsal, no nothing. Just went in and tore all that stuff up.
You discovered him and you championed him, correct?
Yeah, but it was a whole bunch of guys. He and Bobby Hutcherson, I played in this coffee house over in Pasadena, and those guys would come around, Herbie Lewis and stuff like that, you know. And I'd be playing over there with Higgins and Scott LaFaro and stuff, and those guys would be standing outside the thing listening, you know. But Stinson was a major genius, man. Major genius.
And that's a great record. That record, I don't know why that record hasn't been reissued. It should be.
Thank you for keeping that, because by you talking about it, it comes back to me. It comes back to my heart, because it was so.
I mean, you had an opportunity. He gave you the keys to the car, and you drove it.
Wasn't that beautiful? I'm a young kid.
Yeah.
I said, man, I'm leaving. Now, I started with me at this quasi what do you call that group? Chamber music, you know.
Yeah.
But he had some, you know. See, I came when Eric Dolphy left, and Buddy Collette called me Underground Railroad style and said, you know, I know you teach. See, the master's, yeah. I graduated. I was still in graduate school, and I was working on my master's. I took a gig teaching school. See, the thing about working on the master's is that you can get $30 or $50 more a month from the school district or some kind of bullshit. But you know, man, when I taught school briefly, oh, man, I tell you one thing. There's a guy named Sam Brown. Have you ever heard of him? He taught Dexter and a lot of people over at Jefferson High.
Huh.
And Jerry went through him and a lot of Tapscott, a lot of guys. Anyway, so I'm going to SC, and so I got to do student teaching. So you have to go to Beverly Hills High and that stuff like that. Well, you know, that wasn't calling me, but you know what was calling me was Jefferson. Well, it wasn't on the list of approved places you could go. Well, I filled out my own form and went over to Jefferson and apprenticed with Sam Brown. He was just such a beautiful soul. So in other words, I got to experience the real stuff before the end, you know,
yeah.
And that was very, very touching. I have big props to give to Higgins and Ornette, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and Jerry, especially they were real close. They were playing out in the street one day, and they heard this crazy stuff coming from blocks away, and they started running towards it. And they went in this music store in Watts, and there was Ornette in there trying out a reed. Well, you could try out a reed. But when they heard that shit, they knew that was it. They just went running, man. And, you know,
great.
I mean, so that's the way that record is, Man from Two Worlds. We got off into it. You mentioned Indian stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, see, I was listening to all that stuff in Ali Akbar Khan,
yeah,
and all that stuff. And so I was moved by that, and so I had to make my own things because there was no models for it
and that album's got Bossa Nova on it too, a very interesting, you know, the Forest Flower on there was very mellow and Bossa Nova-ish, and Bossa Nova hadn't really hit yet.
I don't remember. Forest Flower's on Man from Two Worlds?
I think so, unless I'm hallucinating. I
believe. Well, no, you could be right. I don't know. And what was the Bossa Nova? Was that Forest Flower?
Yeah, it was done in a very soft Bossa Nova. Because there were three Forest Flowers that I concentrated on. That one, and then you did it on Discovery, and that was a much harder edged.
Oh, yeah, no.
That record was an anomaly for you, it seems to me.
Yeah, no, that was the right version.
And then the one at Monterey, which is the one that...
Yeah, that was the one they caught. But
yeah.
Here's the thing about Forest Flower, and I mean that whole period. See, when I left and went with Chico, he had the band was playing some straight horn arrangements and stuff. But you know what? What was beautiful for me was that I was infected by New York, you know, and I had to get there.
Yep.
And that's why the Forest Flower was screaming and so crazy.
Yeah,
on that record. But and so I told Chico I have to leave, and he said, "Well, don't leave." He said, "Stay here and do what you want to do." Well, that was like the guy giving me a pilot's license, you know. I'm some kid, you know. And so then I started writing all my own stuff, and I had Gabor and Stenson as a lab, you know. I didn't have Tony Williams, but Chico, he had what he had, you know. And so that's what we did, and so. It was a blessing for me, and
I'm sure it was a young kid coming in there and being given the keys like that.
Right,
that's great.
Right.
And what a great record you put out there. So let me ask you this question: How did the group with Keith Jarrett and Cecil McBee and Jack DeJohnette get together? How did you get those guys together?
Oh, they have different. Everybody's got different stories. But Jack was playing. I was, you know, when I was a Cannonball, I heard Keith up in Boston. You remember the Jazz Workshop?
Sure, yeah. Fred Taylor's place, sure, of course.
Yeah, and so we were playing down there, and Keith was playing upstairs in the bar, the piano in the middle of the bar thing, and he had a singer up there, and that's where he was operating. But he was a student at Berkeley, and during intermission, I'd come up and listen to him, and I knew he had something. You know, he was like a 18-year-old kid or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so then I'd go backstairs, and then he'd run downstairs to hear me. So we had this attraction, and then I went out. But then when it was time to go out on the road, I went out with Gabor and Pete LaRocca and Stenson.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Gabor and I went to Acid, and Stenson I'm sorry, Pete LaRocca and I went to Acid, but Gabor and Stenson were hardcore. They were Tragic Magic guys. So it was two different bands going on. You know, we had to, you know, Gabor was always reviving Stenson and stuff like that. It was really hard out there, man. But anyway, long story short is that while I was on the road, I got this call from Keith, and he said he was out with Art Blakey, and he wanted to play with me. And I told him, well, I'm out here, and it's kind of rough. And so when I get back to New York, we'll talk about it. And at that time, Jack had already been bugging me about playing with me. And so I just put that formation together, and I don't know where Cecil came from. He may have come from Jack, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, but that was a great group, boy.
That group, that was special. You know, what happened was that we went down to play a gig at the Baltimore, called Left Bank Jazz Society, and we hit, and the people went crazy. And so somebody came up to me at the end of the gig and said, you know, it's like a kind of a cult thing, you know, 400 people in a room that's over the top. And that was in the days when people had to have it, you know, they needed the meds. And so the meds or the music. So they said, man, do you know what just happened? I said, well, you know, we just played. Anyway, what you're talking about, the group, people got it. You know, it hit them real strong. And so we began to take no prisoners and go around and keep doing that.
And you got popular outside of jazz, but not trying to do that. That's the cool part about it. It wasn't like you were trying to be outside of jazz.
But see, that was the blessing. That was strange because we were in San Francisco, and this there was a group. You never heard of the Committee, did you?
Of course, I've heard of them. Yeah.
Like the second city.
Yeah,
anyway, so it was one of those guys in a comedy group called the Committee, and they had their own theater building up the street from where I was playing in North Beach. And after Monterey, I came to play in North Beach, and this, what was it called? What's the name of the club? I can't think of it right now. Anyway, so
those not guys, the Lighthouse. Where's the
No. That's in L.A. No, I'm in San Francisco. The Jazz Workshop is across the street from the Jazz Workshop up on Broadway up there on North Beach. Anyway, doesn't matter. Anyway, what's important is that these guys from the Committee loved us, and they called Graham and said, listen, they're these guys, you know, so we went over one Sunday afternoon and invited over to play for half an hour. They wouldn't let us off the stage for over an hour.
Yeah.
And Santana said he was screaming, free the people, Charles, and stuff like that, you know. So it was like early days, and then the Dead caught on to us in the Airplane because I had a friend, Spencer Dryden, who was a jazz drummer.
Sure, yeah, of course.
So anyway, so he and Grace would come by to see me all the time and stuff like that. But what it was that, you know, I was medicating myself, and those guys had the best meds. So we would hang out, and, you know, it was pretty nice, you know.
But you never got caught up in the hard stuff, right?
I'm telling you.
You never got caught up in the hard narcotics.
Tragic Magic is the hard stuff.
Yeah, you did.
I did.
I didn't know that.
I dibbled and dabbled, and you know, you.
But you got out of it.
I had to go away because I saw I was losing it. You know.
You want to hear a crazy sad story? I'll make it quick. But I had this friend of mine who, when I lived in L.A., he committed suicide, and he left me a package outside my house, and I opened the package, and it was his suicide note, and there was an ounce of cocaine in there, and I didn't expect it, and 2 days later, my doorbell rings, I open the door, and it was Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys. Somehow he heard that I had this, and said, hey, Michael, how you doing, man? And I don't know, from a hole in the wall. I said, oh, this is just a terrible drug of this. And then you know who else showed up 2 days later? Don Cherry showed up.
Oh, right.
Showed up. And I was saying, these guys, they come into my house, they don't know me from a hole in the wall, but they know that I got this blow there.
They know where the stuff is.
Yeah, man, that's just so sad.
Cherry used to come over to my house every day in the village. I was living in One Sheridan Square, and he would be on the phone all day trying to make his connection. And you know, and we were tight in L.A. I said, man, I don't like, you know, you come over and you sit on the phone all day, you know. It was like
doing that.
Yeah, right, precisely. So I
not arranging gigs.
Right. No, it was pretty rough.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you came.
Thank you for the hit on Man from Two Worlds. I still can't. I can feel it, you know.
Yeah. So you don't have a big stereo now, right? You don't have.
Yeah.
You do.
I got big stuff. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I got thanks to Harley. I got They gave me I got a new CD player, the CD9, I think, from Audio Research.
Yeah, that's good.
But I got those speakers. I love some speakers that you probably don't care about, but for me, those B&W, the big ones.
The 801s, 802s?
Not the improved ones. The studio monitors. What are they called? 805s or 801s?
I think 801s.
It looks like
a microphone on top, but it's a tweeter.
Yeah, that thing up there. Yeah. Big round thing up top. Yeah. Yeah. So I got those speakers and I got Audio Research stuff. Yeah. Oh,
that's great.
They hooked me up years ago, and the guy, David, what's his name?
Dave Gordon.
Yeah, Dave Gordon said, I was shocked. He told me musicians didn't have good equipment.
A lot of them don't. You know, a lot of them, you know what it is? A lot of them, they play, they gig, and they don't want to get involved in it at home. They want to.
Well, it's expensive, too, though. But the thing is that it really helps, you know.
And I interviewed the main cellist for the Berlin Philharmonic about something, and I said to him, so what do you listen to at home? He goes, I don't listen to music at home. I have enough to do at work. I don't want to listen at home. I want to just sit and read a book and talk to my kids.
I don't know what to tell you. There was a guy in the L.A. Philharmonic I used to buy flutes from. Miles Sentner was his name. And he was the same way. Them guys, they were working, and I don't think they were interested in music at a certain point.
I mean, I've met plenty of musicians who were into good having a good listening experience at home, and a lot of them who are not, and that's fine. You know, it's whatever.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to tell you earlier about my experience in college. I got infected by hearing good sound, you know?
Yeah, that's what happens. And a lot of young people today are doing the same thing. They hear it through a friend, and, you know, some kid's got a turntable, and they've never heard a turntable.
You're right. Is that correct?
It's absolutely happening. I've got a 14-year-old kid writing for me who is a genius. He's 14 years old. He's way into vinyl. He's way into jazz. He's reviewed Dexter Gordon albums for me. He reviewed that lost John Coltrane record that came out that everybody made a big fuss over. He didn't like it.
Mm.
And he reviewed.
I don't remember. I know. I wasn't too crazy about the film that they were acting crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You remember that film recently?
The recent one. Yeah.
Yeah. Several years ago.
Yeah. It was okay. It wasn't great.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. The reason I stopped you in the tracks about that I'm happy to hear that because. I have a friend, and he told me he made a conquest with some little girl, 20-year-old girl or something. He said he took her home, and he said that in the morning he put on his turntable and was playing music. And he said the girl was watching him, and after a while, you know, have coffee or something, and the girl said, you're really listening to that. She didn't know music. Was something that you listened to. She thought it was like background.
Background. That's
background.
That's
stuff,
what's happened.
Know?
That's right.
Yeah, so I was shocked. And then that MP3 stuff really bothered
the
me.
The worst, yeah, because it pushes you away. It makes you not want to listen.
Yeah, right. So that's why I stay on the bass. So your guy was right from Germany. You know, Steve, stay away. But if you get some good sound and can do it, you know, you laugh at this, but I have this thing. B&W makes some little computer speaker. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, they've got a couple of things. They've got a Bluetooth speaker that looks like a blimp. It's like a...
No, this is called MM1 or something like that. It's just a little black box. You haven't seen them, huh? They sound good.
Yeah, they've gotten those little things to sound really, really good. It's not as good as your big system, but it can sound good.
No. But I'm just saying, you know, when you're in a Bob Dylan hurry or something like that, you know, you just go ahead and put that little thing on your computer, and you can listen to some stuff. But I'm glad that the young people are coming around. So are they interested now?
Absolutely. It more and more kids. If you go to record stores, because there are still record stores, it's young people digging out the records. You know, vinyl's made a big comeback. It's mostly young people that are buying records and turntables because they dig it.
I'm a recluse, so I don't know what people are doing out there, but I know what it. But thank you for telling me that.
Yeah, it's happening.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I've taken 40 minutes of your time, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
But I didn't answer anything. That was it about Chico. You wanted to know about that, huh?
How about that whole experience? You talked about it. You know, if you have anything to add, I'm happy to hear it.
Oh, great. Well, no, hey, man, and thank you for caring and listening to my humble recording there and stuff like that. And
I've been listening to your recordings since forever, so it's so great to finally get to talk to you.
Be careful, because I had all those little girls and kids run up to me and tell me that they were created by Forest Flower. You know,
right.
I got pregnant on Forest Flower, blah, blah, blah. And I don't, not that many, because I've got a royalty statement. It never said that those many people, you know, millions of people around the world, they all say, well, you know, after you played and on TV, you know, my mother and father went into the bushes.
Yeah, well, that version has got something, that particular version live, you know, the air.
Yeah,
in Monterey comes through that record.
But did you know Leonard Feather bombed it, you know?
He didn't like it?
No, he said we were terrible or something, you
Who
know?
Who cares? And, Who cares what
right.
critics
oh,
say?
Oh, no, I'm just precisely, no. And then later on, so I shut him out, and later on he tried to come around. I said, no, thank you, man. But you just, it's the thing I was telling you about Bob. You know, they say, you know, you're going out to the place, going to fall into the ocean. Yeah. You have to follow your own bells, man.
How did Bob talk? Did he talk like this kind of way? Is this how we talk? Kind of like this?
Yeah, like Bob.
My favorite Bob Dylan quote is, apparently Peter Grant, who was the manager of Led Zeppelin, came up to Bob Dylan backstage and said to him, I manage Led Zeppelin. And Bob said, I don't give you my problems.
Right. Yeah, right. Of course. So, I don't know. I don't know what people think this stuff is. But I like one thing. Don Was told me that when that we made a single of Bob's song. You know, what's that song? Is Your Money That Good? Do You Think It Could Save You? That stuff. What's that song?
I don't know.
Masters of War.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, he said,
that's right.
That,
yeah, you did.
He said that Bob ran up there and had to have a copy of it, so it knocked him out. You know,
cool.
So that was very. So we long distance people now, and everybody's in their own spaceship and stuff like that. But every now and then, something will come through like that.
Yeah, you're perfectly willing to be eclectic, and you don't worry about anyone calling you a sellout or.
Oh man, they can kiss my ass.
Yeah, who needs that?
I'm still drunk with the music, and as long as that's going on, why the fuck I'm gonna care about what some motherfucker who can't play gonna say something about my shit?
Exactly.
If you look at my history, which I don't look at,
I do.
I do know I'm appreciative. I do know that there's a body of work back there. I'm still interested in going forward because the beginner's mind won't let me alone, you know. And I'm still drunk with that.
Yeah.
And I got two blessings. That's it. You remember the guy said I had two great qualities. The first is my memory. And the second is I can't remember. No, but mine is the beginner's mind and the benefit of experience.
Yeah.
You know, because I played with Wolf, man. I saw women pulling his pants down on the stage and stuff, and he'd be up there howling and shit. You know, and I mean that was the real shit.
Yeah.
I never got moved by nobody like Wolf yet. I mean, I played with BB and Johnny Ace and all them cats, but Roscoe Gore, but BB.
And where did you do that? Was that in Memphis?
Memphis, all this Memphis stuff, you know. And those guys.
When did you first get on a stage? How old were you?
Probably about 9 or something like that.
Wow. You got all these guys staying at your house, so it's got to infect you.
Oh, yeah, so check this out. This is deep. So Hap was staying in our house. He'd be in a little apartment he stayed in, and he'd be back there reading the Bible all the time. So, and I couldn't wait for those guys to get up because I wanted to pounce. I had questions about Bird and stuff. So what's deep is that I wanted to sell my alto. I played alto in those days, and I had some broken down bush or a con or something. You know, so I said, you know, and so my mom says to him, you know, he wants a Selmer, and he, you know, he's just a beginner, and with a Selmer, and Hemp told her, he said, you know, miss, he said, if a professional needs a Selmer, he needs one all the more.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
That's the most thrilling thing I ever heard.
I love that. I love that thing. You tell a kid, here, start out with this piece of crap and you'll love it, and then we'll get something better. No.
He said if a professional needs it, he sure. Man, I never got over that. And pretty soon I got my Salmer, man, and then I start, the Hyperion shit flying through the air. Because when I dream, I float on my back, and so I can hold. And then the other thing was when I first got my horn, whatever it was, Bush, I play a con tenor now. I don't play a Selmer now because I found out something later on. Yeah, I'm a Prez man, so something happens where if you're a sound guy, something happens. Now I'm hearing, because I'm playing con, these old cons, the young cats are getting into that now, but I'm still going ahead. But see, if I was waiting to listen to what somebody told me to play, it wouldn't work.
Yeah. So what, a lot of jazz has become very cerebral and mathematical and not reaching into the gut, and that's a problem, don't you think?
Well, I stood on the stage with Wolf, and you don't get, you can't run away from that.
No, probably not.
I'm sorry. I love J.S. Bach, but Wolf, man, that was, and he said, and then he said, money? He said, I spent more money than any millionaire. He said, women's great gookly muckly. So them guys, I was a little kid, but I was really, man, they had me, man, because they were the real deal of what that was they were doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know my Bobby Blue Bland story. I don't have to tell it, but I've told it many times. You know it, right?
I don't know it, no.
Oh, man. So I'm going with Roscoe Gordon over to Helena, Arkansas for some little gig. And he was piano playing, he was singing. He had a regional hit and stuff. But Bobby Blue Bland was like his protege or something. So we're sitting in the back of this funky station wagon, and Bobby Blue Bland's got this grease and shit falling all over my little head.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, Junior, you can fuck up any song, but Peaches, now Peaches is my theme song. If you fuck that up, I'm going to whoop your ass.
Yeah.
So we're playing some little schoolhouse of picnic and barbecue and gambling and all that shit. And so he said, I was so scared. You play for like 2.5 hours, then you take like half hour intermission, come back and play for another 2.5 hours or so. So I ran out and hid in the car, and I saw him come out of the building. And, man, I was scared because he's big and greasy. I mean, really big. And so somehow he came over to the wagon, and he looked in there, and he found me, and he grabbed me, and he hugged me. And he said, Junior, he said, you played Peaches better than anybody ever played it. Well, the thing for me was that I was so fucking scared, I didn't know which song was Peaches. I mean, so that tells you something right there.
Yeah.
If you can get that compliment from that guy, you're afraid,
Just as well that you didn't know what that song was, probably.
Perception, yeah. So, anyway, like that. Brother, man, thank you for caring, and thank you for loving music. Big love, my brother, and thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.